You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Clock has promised this hour we're going to be looking at inequality. Now, inequality, we know, is a scourge in this country and the world over, but it is very important that we keep track of the trends so that we can understand the beast in terms of ways in which it continues to grow and behave, because we can't talk about the interventions unless we understand the trends, both over the medium and long term, but also just in the past 12 months, which is why the latest report of that sort out from Oxfam is incredibly, incredibly important, and we're going to be drilling down into the details of it. We'll take our time on the show to go through the report quite carefully before jumping into it, even though it's very tempting to simply take the executive summary and the media statements that come out, which is there's a guide for us as journalists, and run with those. But really, the devil is in the detail, and it really is devilish detail, this. I've got two guests joining me this hour. I want you to listen to the facts and the analysis, and then I'm going to invite you to engage as well. But although you know what inequality looks like because you live in an unequal society, I live in it, we live in it, I think it's really important that we get a grip on the empirical complexities here before you and I jump in with our own viewpoint about what to do about it. First on the line is the director of Study in Poverty and Inequality Institute, Isabel Fry. Isabel, good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Good morning, and I'm sorry I couldn't be in studio, but I'm actually at the Chiwelo Community Clinic in Soweto, so thank you very much for inviting us.
That's okay. You're at the coalface of inequality right now in terms of public health, so that's exactly where you want. I mean, in a sense, your contribution can be just to describe to us what you're seeing in Soweto, really, contrasted with what I'm enjoying in Sandton, and that really will give us a stark picture. But we'll come to that in a little bit later. Basani Baloyi is Senior Fellow Research and Policy at Oxfam South Africa. Basani, good morning, and thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, and good morning to all your listeners as well.
Basani, I'm going to start with you. Before we deep dive into what are the drivers, and then importantly, what will we do about inequality, I think the numbers matter hugely. So let's talk about some of the global trends, and then specifically what's happened in South Africa. The numbers are so scary, you can almost like take any one of them, and it should hopefully yank someone out of their complacency. What for you are some of the numbers that stand out?
Well, I mean, one of the big numbers that stand out is basically the fact that, you know, we are having a situation where there's an increase of basically $2.5 billion a day, right, of wealth that is being created by the billionaires. That is a staggering amount of money. And another being that...
So that's per day, just in the last year.
That's per day, just in the last year. $2.5 billion increase in the amount of wealth. A billionaire every 2 days is another one. The fact that, you know...
And contrast that with what the bottom 50% losing their wealth by what, something like 11%?
11%, right? Just in 1 year. Okay, this is what we are seeing.
Jeez.
And then when you look at South Africa, which we are, of course, putting this global trend closer to home, although our numbers of billionaires have decreased in the last year from seven in 2017 to five in 2018, you would think that that decrease would result in a trickle-down effect to the vast majority, right? But actually what has happened is that there's been a trickle-up to those very spoiled billionaires by who've experienced a 15% increase in their wealth, which means that it's increasingly, just in the last year, wealth is increasing in right at the top. So, yeah, those are the very scary trends that we are seeing.
So the share of wealth of South African billionaires have increased. Is that accurate?
So what we are saying is that it has increased, but it's concentrated. Okay. So the number of, this is in dollar terms though, right? So the number of billionaires in dollar terms has decreased in the past year. However, what we are finding is that instead of trickling down, right, it has trickled up in terms of 15% of their, like they've increased their wealth by 15% as a result.
But Sunday, what is also important is the rate with which the decline is happening in terms of extreme poverty.
Yes.
So if someone just looks at the slope of a graph,
yes,
they may be optimistic if it shows that the number of people, say, in sub-Saharan Africa are decreasing.
Good. Yeah.
But one of the things that stand out for me is that, and we're going to come back to South Africa, which is even worse than the rest of the region.
Yes.
But sub-Saharan Africa as a, Africa as a region, the rate at which we are successfully dealing with extreme poverty is slowing down?
So what we are saying in terms of that is that globally, right, we've done well in reducing extreme poverty, okay? However, as you're saying, globally, the rate in which we are doing that is slowing down. But in sub-Saharan Africa, what we are finding is an increase in extreme poverty, and in South Africa specifically, there is that increase, and it's increased between 2011 and 2015. I forget the
I've got the numbers here. Let's have a look at them, because, I mean, I'll put the politics aside for the moment, because the political analyst in me reads this and goes, it is astounding that the ANC may be returned with a 60% majority with these numbers. That tells you a lot about these, the state of opposition politics, because these numbers alone should drive political discontent. But we'll leave the politics for 1 minute. Here are the data, right? So the South African experience, you guys say, Bassani eyes follow the proportion of the population living in poverty initially, and this was the good news for the state, declined from 66.6%, which translated into 31.6 million persons in 2006 to 53.2%. I mean, that's a good story to tell, as it were, in 2011. And then suddenly we see this jump back from 27.3 million persons living in poverty in 2011 over the subsequent 4 years, all the way up to 30.4. So what does that tell us? That we are undoing the gains that we had experienced between 2006 and 2011, and now the trend is being reversed again.
Absolutely. That is what we are seeing. And I mean, it's incredible that in 4 years, really, that this would be the trend. But like, this is data that is coming out of Stats SA, and it's quite frightening.
I was too scared to ask you the next question, which is, do we even begin to know what happened after 2015 in the last 3 years or so?
Well, we can kind of like extrapolate from that, right? We have had a technical recession. The job numbers have not been good, rising unemployment. And so you could think that, you know, this would be a continuation. And mind you that in 2011, there was still a commodity boom globally, right? So that it was not it had no trickle down effect here, is something that is quite troublesome. And
so there's no reason to believe, given those exogenous factors,
right,
and also what happened, you know, after the commodity boom that you're talking about, the state of our economy, low economic growth, employment, unemployment is going up, chances are that this reversing of the eradication of poverty has probably continued.
Has probably continued. And by Stats SA's account, and I'm quoting them here, if I can get it, but basically they're saying that in terms of inequality, the measure of that being the Gini coefficient, right, we are nowhere closer to actually meeting our target, our National Development Plan target of reducing it to 0.6 in the rate at the rate at which we are going. It's currently at 0.63, I think, and we are nowhere closer to that. So it is quite worrying in terms of the pace, not only of poverty increasing, but then the fact that inequality is, of course, very stubborn.
Absolutely. Isabel, I'm going to bring you in a second. Yeah. I'm going to bring you in 1 second. There's just one more data point I want to give the public. So Bassani and I have spoken about poverty. But Sunny, there's another number here, lastly, for now, that I want us to introduce, which is not just poor persons, but extremely poor persons.
Yes.
Because you guys say that the number of extremely poor persons have also increased from 11 million in 2011 to
13.8 million in 2015.
That is an increase in percentile terms of 21.4% to 25.2%. I mean, that is astounding.
That is extremely astounding. Now, what do we mean by extreme poverty?
Yes.
And that means that people who are living below 441 rand per month. That is what we mean by that. That is how much it has increased again in those 4 years.
That really is scary, because there are some people who have hangovers this morning that are more expensive than that.
Absolutely. Who can live off 441?
Isabel, I want to bring you in here. Do these numbers surprise an expert like you?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I just want to start off by saying well done to Oxfam for keeping the attention on inequality and poverty, because it's something which slips off the radar far too frequently.
Yes.
Are those numbers surprising? No. I think that what for me is surprising is that we are not paying more attention to them.
Mm.
I mean, one of the things that even the World Bank, which is not known for its most radical analysis, admitted in 2018 in the inequality report, that South Africa, most of my analysis, Eusebius, is going to be South African-based.
Yes. Mm.
South Africa is the most unequal country in the world, looking at income inequality, ranked out of 149 countries. Now, if you were looking at our economic growth, and we were lowest out of 149 countries, we would have all the brains around the table looking at what we do about it. But we come up with these data points and reports about inequality, and then we continue as if everything was fine.
Mm.
One of the interesting points that you two were talking about was the link between poverty and inequality. And as far back as 2006, the World Development Report identified that the link between poverty and extreme inequality, which is what we're facing, is where you have countries with high income inequality, it's almost impossible to address poverty. So there are different dynamics, but that baseline of high income inequality means that those social mobilities, all those ways of moving out of poverty, are denied to the majority of people.
Yes.
And so in a way, what we need to be very conscious of is looking at both income inequality and poverty. But the other thing that I want to throw out, I think the Oxfam report was really interesting, because the topic was basically public goods and private wealth and private health. For the first time, I've seen a challenge thrown down, which is to say, what is the impact of the privatization of public goods and the cost that that has on majority of people? I think my one point that maybe we can chat about, Bahani, is also looking at me in South Africa. One of the big problems is the question of both unemployment, but also low pay. So
yes.
If you look at the OECD 2010 report that Murray Leibrandt and Mehmet Sardou did, they were saying that a greater driver of inequality was not unemployment, but the wage gap currently in South Africa.
Yes.
And as one of the people who negotiated the very controversial national minimum wage at NEDLAC, it's one of the things that we were very conscious of, is that it's a starter.
I'm going to come to that in a second, because that's obviously a very controversial issue, depending on whether on the ideological orientation of the economist, you'll be told that the quickest difference you can make to decreasing inequalities is to get more people working and not to have minimum wages. And then others are saying, no, we need to do both. It's callous to put the unemployed against the poorly paid worker. I want to spend some time on that in a second, Isabel. But I wanted to ask you a different question, Isabel. Can we also talk about the South African context, not just racially, but also how gendered the inequality numbers are? And keep it very practical. Right now, where you are, for example, it is invariably women that have to do unpaid work when our public health system breaks down and we have to look after people. They become effectively care workers. It's not socially recognized. They don't get remunerated. And also, there's an opportunity cost that comes with the kind of burden that these inequality data disproportionately put on the shoulders of women.
Absolutely,
serious. I think it's interesting that you raise that. I mean, I'm using 2015 stats. The Living Conditions Survey of Stats SA, just interestingly enough, looking at the racial income inequality that you referred to, the average black household in 2015 had a consumption, they spent $67,000. The average household, white household, spent $350,000. So that is that discrepancy that hasn't changed. But if you bring in gender, and if you look at the stats again, black African women being the people on whose shoulders the burden of poverty falls most heavily, for women-headed households, the average spend was 98,000 rand over that year. The average spend for a male-headed household was 165,000.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, your listeners are going to be inundated with stats, but I think it's important to understand that for 77% of male-headed households, income came from work, whereas for women, that was much lower at 63%, and more women-headed households had an income from social security, social grants, which really goes to that question that you raised of the unpaid burden of care for social reproduction. Because in South Africa, we've got this weird social security system that is inherited from apartheid. So essentially, it relies on full employment for working males, which were basically working white males. We have no social grants for women or men, between the ages of 18 and 59. So if you fall into those households where you are unemployed, either because there is no employment or you have to care for children, for old age people, you don't have the ability, notwithstanding the fact that the Constitution gives you a right, to get access to any kind of social grant. And the state, as the Oxfam report brings out, is meant to be the normalizer, the stabilizer of income distribution within a society. And we've got a huge problem because we're ignoring the fact that the majority of people of working age who are poor are facing these burdens, and women are carrying that. Whereas what many of us in NEDLAC are negotiating right now is a much more comprehensive social security. We're looking at options like a basic income grant. Mm-hmm. And yet you've got this conservative backlash that says give people some kind of income, they'll become lazy. That's as if there are so many well-paid jobs that people are rejecting.
Absolutely. But Sunny, I want to bring you back here.
I can keep on this, but let me...
no, those are excellent. And you've got us into the next theme. And I want to know which bits Oxfam agrees, which bits they underscore, and what you have said, where they may add to that in terms of the drivers.
Mm-hmm.
What are the most important drivers? Because people tend to listen to this conversation from a position of wanting to reinforce their own hegemonies.
Absolutely.
And not dealing with our own privileges and luck that we have. Mm-hmm. And so we cherry pick.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will say, I hear what Isabel is saying, I hear you, Basani, but the real problem is, if you turn on the telly, you will see that the state of the state is rotten.
Mm-hmm.
We pay our taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me about paying low wages, Isabel. I employ people.
Mm-hmm.
The real problem is Jacob Zuma, the ANC, and what happens in the state. What is Oxfam's top tier analysis of what explains the numbers in the South African context?
Okay. Thank you for that question. Very important. Now, this report basically builds from last year's report, which Isabel touched on, and which looked at the world of work, right, and looked at how wage inequalities drive inequality, right? So we are now building on that, and we are looking at public services. The fact that the underfunding or how universal public services, that's healthcare, education, social protection, how those are very central in reducing inequality as a measure, one of the measures. Okay, so that is basically what our major finding of, which is the fact that if you undertax, the wealthy, which is what has been happening over the last 30 years, right, you don't have the resources to then put into the public services system. Now, what we are not...
I want to just interrupt and have you pause on that, because firstly, in this report, I just want you to clarify for the public, when we talk about the super rich, what are we talking about? Because they sound like super bugs. They sound like not you and me who may be middle class, but like the super rich. So who is the super rich? Are all people on the cushy side of the Gini coefficient in South Africa under text, or is it only the super rich?
We are talking about the super rich. We are talking about the dollar billionaires, right, who find ways... also dodging the tax system, basically not to put money in the fiscus as they should be doing. Okay, so we are talking to those people. We are talking to corporations, major corporations, for instance, who have in 1990, for instance, the corporate tax rate was at 50%. And when was that? That is apartheid, South Africa. It's declined to 28%. What does that mean then in terms of delivering services? right? It's ridiculous. And even some statistics that I can pull out that come from something that Isabel is a part of, a taxpayer that was earning $1.5 million in 2018 pays $110,000 less than they should, than they did in 1990. So we are saying that top tax rates for those who are right at the top of the income or income distribution, they have been declining, okay. Right?
But a person who earns $1.5 million is not super rich.
It's not, yes, that is not super rich, right? But what we are also seeing is the fact that at different levels, right, we are seeing a reduction as well. Okay, but we are saying let's tax, especially the super rich, and redistribute the money.
So simply put, and I know we can't put it simply, Isabel, mm-hmm. because these things do require definitions, mm-hmm. right? But are we suggesting, Isabel, that in general, wealthy South Africans who often moan that they disproportionately shoulder the tax burden are factually wrong?
Absolutely. And here again, the interesting thing, Eusebius, is that with the advent of studies led by people like Thomas Piketty, I can't pronounce the French name, sorry, and others, we're now concentrating on wealth data. In the past, it was always income data. And what we found, and I'll speak to the figures now, is how wealth, especially accumulated apartheid wealth, is not being touched. But I just want to refer to something Basani was talking about in terms of South Africa. There was a 2011 study by SARS. So again, our data, we've got to take what we can get. But there were 2,600 high net worth individuals. And for your definition, Eusebius, that's people who earn in excess of 75 million.
Okay.
But of that 2,600, only 360 were registered taxpayers.
Wow.
So definitely there is a huge shift and a gap. Again, if we look just quickly at the question of wealth, The World Bank report again found that 1% of the richest South Africans had control owned 70.9% of all assets.
Yes.
So again, a huge concentration, and 10% basically own about just well over 90%. Huge concentration of wealth. This is not taxed, and that's one of the things that Oxfam and other activist organizations such as the Budget Justice Coalition that SPY belongs to is saying, is that we need to look at wealth. Now, it's interesting, in the last budget, last February, there was an attempt to look at, to increase basically wealth tax in two modalities. And this is just for your listeners. So if you die and you're wealthy, you pay a state duty. And also if you sell assets, you pay capital gains tax. But let's just remember, as you guys are saying, your top income brackets for tax is 45%. But if you look at when you die, your inheritance tax, that is only 25%. And that increased from 20% of what you leave to 25%, an attempt to tax wealthy people, but that was only for estates in excess of 30 million. So I don't think we really are coming down to where much of the wealth is. And the other point being capital gains tax is that both estate duty and capital gains are much lower than income tax. So you're taxing the middle classes who don't own the assets, but it's the wealth, and wealth generates more wealth. It does a lot of things, but it enables those who have to have more at a rate that doesn't come into the fiscus. So you get middle classes complaining about the fact that they get taxed, and they do get taxed. Two things that I think that I've heard you picking up on, which is useful, is firstly people's attitudes, and secondly, state allocation. I want to just quickly refer to people's attitudes because, you know, we often detract our well-being in, I mean, our Ubuntu in South Africa. The South African Social Attitude Survey run by the HSRC found that 75% of South Africans think that we are too unequal and something has to be done about it. So we are not blind to it. We're looking at leadership and we're looking at ways in which we can do that. But I think that as activists, we could be encouraged about the fact that people want things to change.
That's right. And I'm going to devote the bulk of the second half of this hour to how we can bring about that change. Just one more question in terms of the diagnostic element of this discussion, and then I'll also invite the public to have a crack at engaging your diagnostic analysis and also their solutions that they may have, Basani. So I wanted to be clear. When we talk about the underfunding of public services like health, education, social services, I know it's Well, it's not actually impossible to quantify, so I want to know whether Oxfam got that far, and Isabel can tell me whether there are other sources that have done this. What percentage of the underfunding of these critical areas of life and the state is due to corruption money that is lost to, for society because we can't get it back or it's difficult to get it back? And what percentage of that problem is a problem as a result of tax avoidance and tax evasion and regressive tax policies in relation to the super rich?
Okay, that's an excellent question. We didn't get that far.
In other words, or to put it differently for the public, if the Guptas and the Watsons never existed, would we mind as much that the super rich don't get taxed more?
Yes, we would mind as much. And I'll give you this example of health, right? It's an excellent example. Nearly 50% of the health budget subsidizes private healthcare, which goes to about, I believe, 8 million or 8.2 million of the population. Nearly 50% of the health budget, of the national health budget, subsidizes 8.2 million of the population. The rest, 50%, goes to 42 million of the population. That's a gross, I think, underfunding of what of a crucial, essential service that is meant to basically support life in this country.
I need to go to the news headline, so just keep this one short. If you want more time, we can finish it before we talk solutions. But someone can also listen to that particular fact that you've just given and said, what you are describing is a regressive allocation of the existing money as opposed to a shortfall in monies needed to deal with healthcare.
Right.
Which is it?
Can I come in here very quickly?
Very quickly, Isabel.
Excellent example. If you take Social Security, this is regressive. The amount of money that gets given back to taxpayers who pay into a pension fund is more, so that's money that the state doesn't take, gives back to the middle classes, is more than the total budget per annum that's spent on old age pensioners that the state provides.
Okay.
So that's another way where the gap doesn't come into the fiscus, and yet there's a class differential that goes out.
Wow.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
On 702 at Cape Talk.
25 minutes before 11 o'clock, a couple of you have been asking. Her name is Basani Baloyi. She's a senior fellow, research and policy at Oxfam SA, who is in the studio with me. And we're talking about the Oxfam report into inequality. And of course, also the excellence of Isabel Fry is what you're hearing on the phone line with me, who's the director of Study in Poverty and Inequality Institute. I want you to call in. You've heard the numbers now. Experientially, we know we live in an unequal society, but it's very important to get robust data behind these things. What are your thoughts? What comes up for you as you listen to Basani and also to Isabel? And then I want to shift slowly, thematically, this next 20 minutes to the question, what can we do about it? What are we going to do about levels of both income and wealth inequality in particular here in South Africa? 011-883-0702 in Joburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Jane, good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, good morning, CBS, and your guests. I just walked in and caught what your guest said at the last bit about the wealthy not bearing the most burden. And a couple of years ago, I read a book by Joseph Stiglitz, The Price of Inequality, which you've probably read because you like those sort of things. And it's completely, it's about America, but it's completely brilliant about how, you know, exactly what she was saying. The poor just get poorer and poorer and more desperate. The middle class generally are eviscerated, and the big corporations and the very wealthy really don't pay an awful lot, you know. So it's a very good wake-up book, and he does try and give some ideas on how it could things could improve, another world is possible. But it's such a marvelous book, and it makes one think very much about what you're talking about.
Thank you, Jane. Much appreciated. Julian in Greenpoint. Good morning, Julian. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to point out, and it goes to Gwen and Gwenya's point as well, is one of the reasons that South Africa in particular has a growing inequality is that the you know, we prioritize transformation over alleviating policy. And I'll use the example of the cell phone companies. Is instead of compelling the cell phone companies to give away as a tax, to give away data to the poorest of the poor, people who are on welfare, Instead, we give away shares in the cell phone companies to already rich BE guys like Patrice Motsepe and Imzi Kamalo and Tokyo Sekwale. So what we're doing is we're transferring wealth from rich whites to rich blacks without benefiting the poor. And it's made worse by the fact that the rich whites lend the rich blacks money, and they then have to recover extraordinary margins and have to actually make more money to pay the interest to buy their BE stakes. And the Chinese model is completely different, where they allow certain huge industries, where they force them to help poor people. And I just think that that's the model South Africa needs to adopt as far as telecoms, banking, petrol. You know, there's a million industries that are dominated by huge players. And I just think that money's just being transferred from rich whites to rich blacks. And the poor people are paying for it, by the way, with increased prices.
Fund the deal. Absolutely. Thanks, Julian. Isabel, how do we begin this next theme then? So we understand the minutiae. We could drill down into more of them. But anyone who's not yet convinced there's a problem is either in deep denial or they probably want to hold on to their own largesse. In terms of the solution space, where should this conversation coalesce?
Solutions are actually used to terrify me, and now they delight me. So I think it's a really good way to proceed. Firstly, I think Julian's point was quite useful in terms of posing. What you've also referred to, Anbasani, is why are things not changing? We've got the diagnostic. Why are they not? And in whose interest is it to keep the status quo?
Yeah.
It's one of the things that Oxfam last year and a couple of other commentators on inequality have identified, is that when you get a coalescing between the political elite and the business elite, you're not going to change the status quo. So although we know economically it makes sense to broaden up the economy, to redistribute the purchasing power from bank accounts into people's pockets, we know that. We know that South Africa is the most unequal country in the world. Yet if you look at the National Development Plan, by 2030, its aim is to eradicate poverty, but to reduce inequality from 0.69 to 0.6. 0.6 is still an outlier globally. So that in essence is the class challenge, that we want to perpetuate the inequalities between the income classes. So we need to firstly be very honest in terms of where we see ourselves. If we took the per capita income and redistributed it, we would be looking at an amount of about 4,500 rand per person. Now, at SPY, what we've done is we come up with a decent standard of living, which says is about 7,033. But it means that those few minority, all of us, who have, are going to have to look at redistribution. So if you look historically, sorry, Eusebius and Basani, but if you look at 94, we had the idea of grocery redistribution. If you take and you redistribute it equally, we will grow. And then you had Gear in 96 that came in and said, no, let's keep what we have. But then that which we produce more of, we'll redistribute. So redistribution through growth. So when you hit a bit of a problem and you're not growing, there's no redistribution that's happening. So very briefly, Eusebius, just to get the ball rolling, what do you do? Firstly, I think the emphasis on universal public goods is really interesting. So we're saying that let's make sure that people are getting access. Education in South Africa, state education, 60% of public schools are now fee-free. You look at a healthcare. We also need to question mark, and maybe Basani can look at this, is what do we do about private? I would love to outlaw private, and I know that I'm a hypocrite because I have private medical care, but my daughter goes to a state school, and I think that we need to be committed to improving state services. The other thing is, I think, a massive income redistribution. I think through social grants, we need to be saying, let's shake it up. We're not going to be creating jobs. The fourth industrial revolution means that the semi-skilled, which is where the poor are currently skilled, are going to be automatized the jobs in a much greater extent. We're not going to be able to fill that gap in this generation, I don't think. The emphasis on education as social mobility necessity is there. What happens right now, a redistribution of income as well as looking at the architects, but then saying to people, what is the challenge? Can we see ourselves as a less unequal country?
Okay, I want to come to some of those interventions in a second. So just headline some of the most important ones for me, and then we'll pick what we can feasibly talk about in greater detail. Basani.
So indeed, I couldn't agree with Isabel more. Okay, redistribution is very critical. Okay, and in this report, we are talking about public services and universal public services. I just want to put this to your imagination. Gabriel Palmer, who's an economist in Cambridge, he had a report in which he found that globally, how the top 1% has been increasing their share has been by expropriating the wealth of those who are in the bottom 40%, right?
Eusebius MacKaiser.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
On 702 and Cape Talk.
Isabel, react for me to that sentiment that getting Eusebius's cousin on the Cape Flats into any form of employment is more important than finding creative ways to tax Eusebius more.
I'm glad that you are gainfully employed, Eusebius, and that you're not hanging around. Because
you know what happened to idle hands.
Exactly, you're a terrifying prospect. But I think that we need to unpack that because it is a knee-jerk reaction. And there's an ideological link to what people call the unemployed, the undeserving poor. That if people are lounging around, you shouldn't give them benefits. Now, firstly, we've got, there's so many things that come to mind. We've got constitutional rights to dignity, to social security. The point is, there is very little dispute that our education in South Africa has let down a lot of people. We've got a number of people who have stuck through school 12 years and are essentially unemployable. So the question about skilling is important, but also skilling appropriately. We know a lot about the fourth industrial revolution in theory. We know that it was driven by the East, where they have an aging population, hence they don't have people to reproduce the labor market, and so they've automated it. In South Africa, we don't have that problem, but we are now entering into a global economy. People don't have jobs. So I think that's a very short-term idea, which is to give people jobs. The other thing is you don't want to have a greater percentage of people being working poor. Where people, again, because you need to kickstart that economy. What is the point of paying people very little so that they have a job if they can't drive the economy through their demand? So that's, as I said, very short-sighted. We need to be looking for future development. We need to have people earning sufficient to demand. But we also need to be looking at the skill sets that are required for the kinds of economic competitive areas that we have. We've had commodities. We're not going to be having commodities. We've got people who can, for instance, do the kinds of call centers. But why don't we look at training people to code? I mean, basically, coding is the language of the future. And it's not that's not that difficult to grasp. But those are the kinds of ideas we should be...
Just hold on 1 second. We are going to run it. We've only got 2 minutes left. My apologies, Basani.
Okay.
You can do two things for me. Hold on to the thought that you have and share it with us presently. And then secondly, this will have to be a separate conversation.
Okay.
I would love to have both of you here. And I'm going to pit you against a right-wing economist.
Okay.
Brilliant.
One of the big three things we can do, but it's not easy, that your report suggests, which we haven't even touched on, because Isabel is talking about very precise things we may do immediately, is to reflect on how the economic system is fundamentally broken.
Absolutely.
And there is one venture capitalist at the beginning of your report who puts it nicely. He says, I'm into capitalism, but there's different kinds of capitalism, and some capitalists wrongly think, and I don't agree with them even though I'm a venture capitalist, that justice is a natural byproduct of market capitalism, as opposed to asking how can we infuse the market capitalism system with a commitment to justice and to inequality. So we can talk about how to tinker with the system and how to do a little bit of plumbing, but fundamentally, the economic system is broken.
Absolutely. Fundamentally, the economic system is broken, right? And basically, in South Africa, like when we think about the structure of our economy, it's not one that is labor-absorbing fundamentally. It is one that is highly capital intensive. And so just to think that, by extracting as much as possible, that you are actually going to absorb the labor that is required is not the case, which is why we have structural unemployment. Mm. It has to do with the way in which the structure of the economy has been organized. Highly capital intensive, not labor absorbing system, right? And one thing that I needed to put to your mind in closing is the fact that in terms of the working poor, as Isabel said, you need to give the people money to buy the various things that are required, not only for their subsistence, but as a way of stimulating the economy. You cannot have, because it's actually dangerous if you don't do that. Mm. It's dangerous because what ends up happening is that you have one way in which the unemployment or the fall in wages was dealt with in America, which is similar to South Africa, is through expansion of credit, right? And that is basically saying, actually, we do not have these. Basically, this is how you try to ensure that there is some kind of a stimulus. However, it is short-lived because, as you know, it blows up, right? And so, for instance, Pick and Pay, it recorded, I think, 12% increase in sales. However, in a technical recession, and how did it do that? It said that actually it had to exploit more workers by putting in more competitive practices in, but also by giving store cards, right, as a way of sustaining its market share.
Yeah.
Why is it? Why are we giving store cards? Fundamentally rigged. We are tinkering at the system, not giving people the money that they want. And what is it for? It's all for greed, right? Because we know we're going to make money off them by giving them credit because we charge them interest rates that will chonisa them. So it's completely as you say, by that hedge fund, a rigged system.
Absolutely. Which puts us perfectly in position for part two of this conversation, which will ask the question, or the dual questions, I suppose, because some capitalists may want to deny this truth. Is the economic system fundamentally broken? And how do we rethink it so that justice and equality can be centered in our capitalist system? Or is capitalism intrinsically incapable of delivering justice? Isabel, thank you so much for your insights. We'll have you back on that set of questions in future. But thank you for today, both for the numbers you've crunched and the insights that came out of it. And the same to you, Basani Baloyi from Oxfam South Africa. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Very-